Accession number 29431, Reel 2.
Mr. Dennis Hayward, Reel
2. You're talking about the living accommodation. At first, things seemed a little bit remote, because although you were mobilised, there was a period where the expeditionary force was sent to France, and you took part in defence organisations. I had to, I think I was a corporal at the time, go up and get some ammunition in early 1940 from an arsenal in one of the London parks. From Putney you could see the awful bombings taking part in London itself, and it was really quite horrific to see, you know, the whole sky lit up and some of the devastation when you went through later on. But before that returned, because I started at Putney, and then I went for a period of time up to Whitby, where living accommodations were, we actually occupied the training school that was set up there. It was in a very nice hotel. And it was a question of training new recruits in Morse and use of early apparatus. And then after a period of time, I was posted back to Putney. And then afterwards, I was actually sleeping on the ground floor of the large school we used at Putney when it was hit by a landmine, and the top floor was wiped out. Fortunately, there's a lot of rubble around me and I got out. But that was then abandoned as training, because I suppose they thought it was a sort of military establishment in the middle of the civilian population. And I was then posted to my field work. In other words, I joined Corps Signals in East Anglia, not too far from Newmarket, and was living quarters there, were in stable accommodation sometimes, which was actually surprisingly comfortable. I mean, they looked after their horses there, didn't they?
So were you sleeping on hay?
On, yes, hayfield things, yes, that's right, yes, yes. But it was interesting work, and we were involved in, you know, getting the best communication we could, both to fixed stations and to mobile stations, and of course communication to the large number of Air Force stations which existed around East Anglia at the time. Went on a number of training courses to Catterick. Catterick was the big signals training school in those days. Radio and various courses like that. And of course all the time you're fighting troops as well. I mean, you might be special to signals, but you had to go through the paces. You had to go on the range. I think I fired an anti-tank rifle on the range and kept up to date with various other things, bombs and things like that, and Mills bombs. But most of the work was with the signals equipment and the command headquarters where we worked.
Yes.
I tended to specialise on radio. The signals units themselves are divided into line work, radio work, and also the dispatch riders at the usual headquarters and things like that. And later on I'll talk about the maintenance section, which is a very small specialised section. But once you specialise on either line work, where you're involved in laying lines, I mean, I did have courses on that. It was quite interesting. You have to remember that signals were initially horse operated. Cavalry, a form of cavalry. And so that cables could be laid quickly, they, instead of wagons drawing guns, we had light wagons, I think probably in the First World War, horse-drawn, and cables on the back there which were spewed out as the truck progressed. Where, of course, in this war, it was a question of on the back of a lorry, or of a 1500-weight or 3-ton lorry, with a motorized apparatus working the drum of cable which was spewed out so that you could lay a cable in short speed along the side of a road you were traveling along. And of course there was also a lot of instruction given generally on the fixed line stuff, in other words the use of post office lines. And a lot of post office lines in those days were copper wires overhead on insulators to cables for each station, for each operator, and multi-cables. Multi-cables came in quite an early stage in the war. I know there was trouble with some of the cables, a quad cable, which means four in one, and we were told there were a problem in some cases that the cattle were chewing the cable, so you had to be careful where you laid that. But I did quite a lot of that work on all those things, but as a general thing, but did tend to specialise on the radio side.
Looking at the bigger picture during this time, how much were you aware of what was going on in other countries?
You were pretty aware. For starting in signals, you usually had receiving apparatus where you could pick up news bulletins, both home and international. And there were forces newspapers as well as local newspapers you could buy, so one was aware. But I could mention this business of the apparatus itself. I was going to talk about the fact that all our apparatus was of course valve operated. It was all before the days of transistors. Now, valves are fairly delicate things, and they also needed quite a lot of high voltage. You needed a high tension as well as a low tension. The low tension to heat the cathode of the valves, and the high tension to attract the emissions from the cathode for the amplification and oscillation which took part in the valves. Now, getting those in civilian days, you had a high tension battery and you had accumulators. Accumulators were small lead acid batteries which pre-war you took down to a local radio shop or sometimes even a cycle shop and got them charged quite cheaply. Not everyone had mains. I remember the first house I lived in, we only had gas lighting, so we had to have batteries. There was also a grid bias battery which was sort of fixed inside the set. All that went by the board when you talked about mobile sets. The mobile sets for the infantry had to be compact batteries, and the compact batteries were special layer high tension batteries, but it was quite a heavy load on top of quite a heavy metal box, I'm talking about the old 18 set, and of course you did depend on the battery life and the replacement of the battery. Now when it came to our apparatus, you had communication was not as you do these days with mobile telephones. You speak simultaneously and you receive simultaneously. Everything was done from the point of view of a separate circuit going out and a separate circuit coming in. So when you switched to send, it was a question, because the transmitter took more power, you had a slight delay before you could start speaking. So at the end of the conversation, I'm talking about, instead of using Morse, you were using telephony. So telephony was comparatively rare. For one thing, everyone could hear it. It wasn't encoded, it was open. And there was a known fact that when telephony was used, for example, in the Norwegian campaign early in the war, we had in signals a system of X numbers, that's a Morse, and a certain signal given out instructed the operator to close down the station until further notice. And we were informed that the Germans had got hold of that and did manage to close down a number of stations by sending out that X code. But fortunately, a lot of officers had served in India and were able to use Indian languages and speak to one another in English, in Indian languages, which I think added some confusion to the Germans at the time. But it was a problem getting the, with our apparatus. All our apparatus worked on large batteries, like car batteries, encased in teak boxes with heavy handles. And part of the maintenance section's job was to keep those charged. They were brought in to us, discharged, and new charged ones collected. And the apparatus relied on that. The high tension on the apparatus in those days was supplied by converters, by generators. In other words, it ran off the 12-volt battery or the 6-volt battery. And when you wanted to transmit, not only did it switch the transmitter on, but it switched a more powerful generator on to supply the power to operate the transmitter, which notably took more power than the receiver. At one stage, it was decided that telephony, radio telephony, needed to be used by commanders in the field. They could always come into our radio stations and sit with us and use it. But it was decided to have a series of vehicles called lorry command vehicles. And I took part in an early experiment where they were all interlinked with radios working to one another. And as well as the interlinking, interconnecting radios, each lorry had a senior officer with them, and also they had the link to various base stations or to the RAF. So the whole thing was a sort of like a great big mobile headquarters. I do remember one of those early experiments we were on, we had a general with us, and we were operating at that time a fairly remote radio link up. And no one had thought to supply the general with any food or anything, so we had to sort of offer him some of our rations at the end, for which he was very grateful. Anyway, that's only a small aside.
At that stage, what rank were you?
Oh, I was a corporal for a long time, and until I went on the foreman course. I went on the foreman of signals course because, well, I think you could apply for this course. I applied for it, and I'd got, I suppose, sufficient number of O levels and things. And the equivalent, an interest in my amateur radio, and was selected for it. It was quite a stiff course, for about 6 months, I suppose, up at Catrick, and you learnt a lot about various trades and technical stuff. I mean, at one stage, I knew by memory the circuit diagram of all the apparatus used we had in use. All the telephones and all the radio apparatus as well. That's a long time ago. I must say I enjoyed it because you know, it was a very small section, a very small group, and I really found myself doing the things I like doing, making specialist bits of communication equipment up, which I later did in fact make some up in the field. So it was quite enjoyable. And then, of course, I was lucky enough to pass it, and you then become, I think, first of all, a lance sergeant, then a company quartermaster sergeant, form the signals, and get posted to a technical maintenance section, where you virtually run the telecommunications side. It was a very small section, a number of very small tradesmen, specialists, electricians, and line mechanics, and qualified, skilled engineers on the telecommunications side, carpenters, but it's very useful in a workshop to be able to make certain wooden components, and to do repairs. And the idea was that we were virtually the first echelon repair, and people brought things to us in the signals unit we were operating with for repair. We had all the spares that we thought we would need, and we could get more spares if we wanted to. And I also devised a system of mobile workshop, a very large, I think about a 5-tonner, we kitted that out as a mobile workshop. And because a lot of our sections, our companies were at various places on the Adriatic coast and various other places in Italy, rather than bringing the apparatus of repair to us, we used to go and repair it. I mean, the telephones, very often you had to replace the carbon microphones in those days, because they were so sort of saturated and they weren't really repairable. And you had to replace the cords and generally clean up the things and put them back as though they were new. But that was the simple apparatus. The more complicated thing was, of course, teleprinters and repeaters, and of course the telephone exchanges, which were taken over. I mean, to go back to the early days of the landing, the big telephone exchange in Naples, the sappers went in before Naples and cleared it for booby traps, and then hopefully we connected things and hoped it worked, and luckily it did. And then of course we had to keep it going. I had a number of interesting special jobs, and where there were problem areas, and I had to go and try and sort those out, and was in fact flown back to Sicily on one occasion for the link working teleprinters over radio to Malta from southern Sicily, and things like that. But by and large, it was a question of keeping things going and repairing what you could, rather than having it, you know, sort of sent away or throwing it away or sending it off to the dump and getting new stuff out. And I think we used to pride ourselves on repairing everything we could. I had some very clever chaps working with us in the TM section. We used to even make parts for the teleprinter, so they were that skilled. And of course we made quite a few bits up ourselves. I used to make up small amplifiers which could be used sometimes where the line was a bit weak, so you had to be careful not, you know, using. There were repeaters, and there were supplied repeaters which worked in a normal way. You had teleprinter lines and speech lines on the same line with this apparatus. Small amplifiers which could be used just in emergency to boost a local connection which you weren't quite sure of. I had one or two sort of visits to remote places. I know, you know, in the early days, go and find a mobile ordnance depot, which was in a large lorry, and all I had was the map reference and the location for a replacement part for a communications receiver. And I was quite excited, really, at the time in finding it. I sort of got there, and the officer in charge said, "Well, no, calm down. What are you excited about?" And I said, "Well, I'm excited at finding you, really, in this remote spot, and that you've got the part I want." And another occasion, we were working in various places on the Adriatic side of it, on the Adriatic coast, which, of course, every bridge was down, and it was quite hazardous getting up and down there. We happened to be moving the other way to an Indian dip, which I did once, and that was a bit difficult. But I had to report to a South African colonel, who then gave me the onward directions to the unit I was trying to find, who were in a fairly remote village in the mountains. And there was a telephone exchange where it was, and we weren't sure. Some of the lines were still had Germans at the other end, and some had some of their own people. It was a bit iffy. But all those sort of things, of course, in those days, it's all part of, you get on with what you're doing.
Were you ever caught out that you couldn't supply the parts that were needed?
Yes. If you couldn't supply the parts, you had to indent for new ones. And this was part of the thing. It was quite remarkable. You sent a demand off via, I suppose, the dispatch riders, and it went through, and eventually you got a parcel which came out from England with the parts in it. Supply was as good as that.
Were they flown out?
Some were. Of course, I probably should have mentioned earlier that I was flown out myself, actually, as a replacement to North Africa. To join the maintenance section just prior to the Salerno landings.
Did you have the mobile maintenance unit while you were there?
Yes, I joined the maintenance section in North Africa, in Tunis.
The one that you devised?
No, it's a setup. A signals unit has a technical maintenance unit. The technical units has formed the signals, and it has a number of skilled craftsmen. And of course, we do have some a bit more technical specialist equipment, and we've got better test meters and that sort of thing. And of course, you do have the facilities of setting up your benches, and you can work on them properly. But one of the responsibilities we had, we had large generators for charging batteries. These were very powerful generators, at about 110 volts with production for banks of the batteries. And so they were charged in large banks at a time. And in the field, the sections had small petrol-operated generators for emergency use, and some of the trucks even could have power takeoff where they could use the power from the engine to generate enough electricity to recharge the batteries themselves. But generally speaking, the apparatus, you knew how long the batteries were going to last, you had meters to read them, the operators did, and you had some in spare. So, you know, it was a sort of routine thing of keeping them charged up and sent out, and of course sometimes replacing them, because after a large number of charges and discharges they weren't as effective and efficient as they were, and they had to be sent off and dumped. No, it was after the North African campaign. I actually landed at a place called Ras El Mar, which is near Fez. It was, we went out, there was another chap and myself were flown out with the mail. The mail was sent out in a funny old plane called an Albemarle, which I think was the body of which was made by the Times Furnishing Company, so you can imagine. No armaments other than my pistol, I think, that was it. And we were going to land at Jew, but we didn't get in there and had to go further down to this place, Fez, Ras El Mar. And there was a heat wave on at the time. It was pretty hot in England at the time, in 43. And landing there, it was very difficult. You took shelter under the plane wings, but you couldn't touch the plane because, you know, you could literally burn if you touched the metal. And in the evening, luckily, I was flown up to Algiers. And some of my unit I was joining, which was line of communication signals, were still there in Algiers. And I had to wait a couple of days there. I was at that time very, very keen on motorbikes. And I persuaded them to lend me a motorbike and had a little trip round Algiers. And I, when I think about it now, I wonder I got away with it, because a large lot of the time I'm sure I was driving on the wrong side of the road, but I suppose being with a motorbike could get away with it. But eventually then I went by lorry from Algiers to Tunis, where I joined the section I was going to work with. And that was a fairly slow sort of trip, but fairly uneventful, except that every time you stop there seemed to be crowds of small Arab boys turning up and trying to scrounge things from you. But and then at Tunis itself we just waited for embarkation. I think bathed, but you know, a little bit sandy. I wasn't very keen on bathing in the sea in those days. Crowds of troops there, and eventually we embarked. Much of our apparatus went by. We went on landing craft, and much of our apparatus, and of course all the vehicles, went on ships. Some of which were lost en route. It was about a 36-hour journey, and one of the memories I have, in fact, when I revisited the Salona landing beach a couple of years ago and called in at the war secretary there, was the actual first landing, because we were actually on landing craft manned by Americans. Didn't have any tea, we had ice water, but of course we had our rations with us, and rolling about on deck, really, waiting for something to happen. But coming in at first light for the landing itself, it was very eerie, because the mountains and the clouds seemed to coincide. You couldn't distinguish which was mountain and which was cloud. And of course there are lots of flashes and noises and things like that. And there were still some dead buried on the beach, with, you know, rifles inverted and helmets on top. We were fairly uneventful, just told to get across the beach as quickly as possible and took shelter. Some old factory, I think, on the back of it. And waited there until the docks were secured and our apparatus and our lorries and things came in, and then we went into Naples. But the actual landing itself, you know, in the middle of the night, is something I shall always remember.
How did you find the Americans?
all very friendly. I know I was a bit faintly amused, really, going down to the docks after we were in Naples and our headquarters were set up, and found that they'd set up an ice cream factory down on the docks. We had quite a lot to do with Fifth Army headquarters, and so they did meet quite a few Americans there. We put one of our specialist radio receivers, a communications receiver, in there for the American use. Well, we got on very well.